Good morning. Yes, thank you. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for giving me an opportunity to share some of my research thoughts on effects of high temperature stress and current understanding and status. I'm going to use the example of heat stress throughout my research. The outline of the presentation is going to be something like this. First, because this is a symposium about perception and stress signaling, so I'll probably spend four slides on giving you an overview how plants perceive the signal and how is it translated into the plant level. And then we'll talk about sensitive stages of crops, especially focusing on reproductive development. And then I'll summarize you the temperature thresholds, or how different crops respond to temperature stress. And then I'll introduce you to the mechanisms of tolerance. I'll talk about only five mechanisms, which I have the experimental data for. And then we'll look into some impacts of the whole plant level and the yield components, and then opportunities for genetic variability and crop improvement. And as I said, most of the examples are going to be from high temperature stress, and I'm going to be focusing on one crop, grain sorghum, but we do have similar information on wheat and some of the other legumes as well. So first, bear with me for the first four slides. It will be a little bit more of an overview and a little bit of biochemistry involved in it. So first, how do plants perceive environmental stress? And again, this is related to temperature and drought. So first, the perception of the stress happens at the cellular level, be it a biotic stress or abiotic stress. And then later on, it is translated through the membranes, especially the plasma membranes, thylakoid membranes, and the cristae. Those are the primary sites of perception. And then from there, the signal is transferred to the cellular and the plant level, primarily through kinases, and they are present across all the membranes. And then once that initial signal transduction happens, and there are several secondary signal transducers which carry the signal, and I've differentiated them in ROS, lipids, sugars, and calcium, and that's what the data I have. I'm going to be talking about only these four signals. But however, there are several growth hormones and growth regulators like ABA, ethylene, NO, jasmonic acid, and salicylic acid, which are also involved in the process. And then once these secondary signals are passed through, then at the cellular level, there is going to be some changes in the transcript, protein, or metabolite assays. And then finally, the cell or the plant will respond to that signal either by tolerance, susceptibility, or adaptation to that stress. So that's the overview of how the signal passes through cell to the plant. Now I'm going to just briefly show you, next four slides, how each of those four molecules transfer the signal. First, reactive oxygen species. They primarily act on four components, either the lipids, sugars, proteins, or nucleic acids, and these are all present in the cell and the membranes of the cell. And then they cause changes in either lipids, and negatively affects the carbohydrate metabolism, and they also disintegrate our protein conjugation and enzyme inactivation, and of course base modification in the nucleic acids. And then in response to that, plant recovery, injury, or death will happen. So that's for the ROS. And the second species is phospholipids in the membrane, because we know membranes are full of phospholipids or made up of phospholipids. And the temperature stress, what it causes is either causes changes in the lipid composition, the type of lipids involved, and then also changes in the saturation level of the lipids, which affects the membranes, and then also lipid degeneration. And this could happen either through glycolipids, phospholipids, or changes in the molecular species, which determine the saturation levels. And then more recently, we are observing that the glycolipids and the oxolipids are specific type of lipids which are overexpressed under heat stress and causes the membranes to be malfunctioning. And the third molecule is sugars or carbohydrates. And there's a different type, either the sucrose, glucose, fructose, and starch. These are the three different types of carbohydrates. And then these, the enzymes which are involved in invertase activities, hexokinase, hexose transporters, hexokinase activities, or there are several other carbohydrate enzymes as well. So I'm going to show you specific examples of this one. And the last one is called calcium protein kinase phosphatase. These are calcium-modulated proteins, and they affect various transcription factors, which lead into the development of heat shock proteins or antioxidants, which further will determine adaptation, tolerance, or susceptibility. So that gives you the overview of what are the various molecules involved in signaling and perception. Now let's talk about the sensitive stages, because it's very critical that we know which stage of crop development is most sensitive to temperature stress or environmental stresses, so that we can see whether you can avoid that stress or identify processes or genotypes which can tolerate those stresses. And when we talk about stress, there are two different types of stress. One is a short-term or very short episodes of stress. And in the climate variability and climate change scenarios, it's expected that we'll be foreseeing more of the short episodes of heat stress or drought stress or flooding rather than a season-long effect. So first we'll focus on that. And I want to just show you the information on floret fertility, because the three important components of the yields are plant population, seed numbers, and seed size. So I want to focus on seed numbers, which is the result of floret fertility or fertilization. So I'll just focus on that. There is, because of the limitation of the time. So most of these experiments were done in controlled environments. So we grew the plants under optimum conditions, and then we exposed the plants at a specific development stage to these temperature stresses, to various intensities, various durations. And then after the stress period ends, we bring the plants back into the optimum condition and where they spend rest of the time. And then in this case, we actually tagged individual florets, because we really wanted to know what that particular floret was exposed, and then did it convert into seed or not. And then in all these experiments, we kept the pots fully irrigated to avoid the water stress. Now, this is for different crops. Hopefully you can see at the back there. So on the left-hand side is wheat. Both the top two panels are wheat. And then this is sorghum and this is peanut. Just wanted to give you a snapshot of various cereals and legumes. So just focus on this left-hand side. This is 5 days of heat stress given at various developmental stages. Zero refers to anthesis. And this is before, 5 days before, 10 days before, 15 days before. And this one is 5, 10, and so on. So this is the data on the floret fertility expressed as percentage of controls. The controls was 100%. So as you can see, this is a U-shaped one. And then maximum reduction in the percent floret fertility is happening at 10 or 5 days before anthesis. And 10 days before anthesis, there's a slight reduction. And this clearly indicates that these two stages, anthesis and about 5 to 10 days before anthesis, is the most sensitive stage for heat stress. And what are the things which are happening at that stage? It is a gametogenesis. Both the viability of the pollen grains and the viability of the stigma is being determined at this point of time. Whereas at anthesis, it's the pollination, pollen tube growth, and the fertilization. So those are the two critical stages. And this is the exposure to 2 days of heat stress in wheat. That again clearly defines those two stages which I was talking about. And the similar information is also available for sorghum and also for the peanut. So most of the crops are sensitive at these two stages, gametogenesis and flowering. And once the embryo is formed, embryo is reasonably tolerant to heat stress until the normal conditions come back. And this is the data on rice. This is 6 hours of heat stress. So even 6 hours of the heat stress during the first half of the day can actually cause decrease in the floret fertility. And genotypes do differ in their response to this heat stress. So there are opportunities for genetic development there. Now let's look into the temperature thresholds response of the overall field crops. This is the work of my career over the last 15 years. I was with Dr. Ken Booty at University of Florida. That's when I started to develop these response curves. So this just gives you the summary of all the work. And I chose harvest index as an indicator, because that really gives us a picture of what is happening throughout the season. It not only takes care of the yield components, but also the partitioning and the biomass production, which is also affected by stress environments. So this is wheat, the yellow line, and the blue is the rice and the sorghum, and millet is the brown one. So among the cereals, this is the ceiling temperature, this is mean daily temperature, that's average of Dmax and Tmin. And among the millets, 41 millet has the maximum ceiling temperature. Whereas for among the legumes, dry bean has the lowest, and then the soybean and peanut is about 40. So crops do respond differently to these season-long temperature stresses. Now, that was a daily mean temperature. This talks about the daytime max and nighttime minimum. And again, among the cereals, pearl millet comes up as the top best one. And among the oil seeds, the groundnut. And among the other leaves, cowpea, soybean, and mung bean. So there exists genetic crop species variability for the stress responses. So that's a summary of the temperature thresholds. Now, that was done in the control environments, either in pots or in the spar chambers. You may ask that how does it affect or how the responses look like into the field conditions. So we did some lot of experiments on field conditions as well using heat tents. And these are our heat tents, so these are movable. You can move them and put them on the crop and then keep it as long as you want and take it off. So you can expose the plants at specific developmental stages. But in Kansas weather, the temperature can go up about 10 to 12 degrees Celsius above ambient during summertime. The only disadvantage of this one is that we cannot control the nighttime temperature. Nighttime temperature, because it's radiation heating, so nighttime temperature will pretty much stay the same. So what we are looking at are the effects of only daytime temperature. So this is a summary of that experiment. In this case, we started the experiments at the start of the heading. That means we moved the heat tents onto the sorghum crop when the plant was starting to head, and then we left it up until the in this case, I think it was seed set. So that's about 15 days. And this is the data on florets per panicle, because the number of florets is already determined by that stage, so there's no effect on that. But the seed numbers per panicle were significantly reduced as a result of loss of floret fertility. Because we removed the heat stress at the time of seed set, so really did not see any effect on the individual grain weight. But overall panicle weight was decreased. This is primarily reflecting the effect on floret fertility and the seed numbers, or the seeds per panicle. So that's what happening at the heading stage. So now let's go into the five mechanisms which I have the data to show, and I'm trying to link this back to the four molecules which I talked about, how the plants perceive the stress, so that you get an overview of that. So for reproductive failure, the first mechanism or the first molecule which I talked was about reactive oxygen species. And then these mechanisms are specifically for floret fertility. So I'm just going to restrict my discussion on floret fertility and the seed numbers. So all the data which you see in these figures are going to be on the reproductive tissue, either pollen or stigma or the entire pistil, that is stigma, style, and ovary all together. So in this case, it's the optimum daytime temperature, 29 degrees Celsius, and high day temperature 39. In this case, nighttime temperature remained the same because this was done under the heat tents. So as you can see, in both pollen and stigma, reactive oxygen species O2 minus is increasing, significantly increasing. It has more in pollen when compared to that of stigma. Relatively, absolute numbers are more in pollen when compared to stigma. And same is also true for H2O2, which is also the hydrogen peroxide as one of the reactive oxygen species. Pollen grains are significantly higher, stigma is higher. So both of these are the signaling, gives the signal and affects the membranes of those reproductive tissues. The second, in general, plants always produce reactive oxygen species, but generally it is at a very low level at which it acts as a signaling molecule. But if the stress is too much or if there is more ROS, that's when the deleterious effects of this on the membranes would happen. And in general, the ROS is always scavenged by antioxidants, because there is always a balance. Plants also produce antioxidants, and there is a balance between the ROS production and the antioxidants under normal conditions. But under stress condition, what happens is the ROS goes up and the antioxidant comes down. So there is an imbalance between the ROS and antioxidants, which leads this ROS to reach the membranes and damage them. So here is an antioxidant capacity as expressed by superoxide dismutase and peroxidase. Again, in pollen grains, significant decrease. Stigma, significant decrease. Same is also true for peroxidases. Okay, so that tells us that there is an imbalance between the reactive oxygen species and antioxidants. Now, the third one was lipids. This is a reasonably new information with the advances in lipidomics. So now we are able to quantify not only the lipids but also the composition and the various types of lipids even in pollen grains. So this one is on pollen grains. The quantities are very low, but we broke the axis so you can at least see that. So in lipid species in pollen grain, it's slightly decreased. pollen pistil is also decreased in this case. This is MDDGs, and then lycophosphatase crinoline or LPC is going up. So what it does is that it changes the unsaturation levels, and once the unsaturation levels are changed, these membranes are very prone to the reactive oxygen species to reach and cause damage, and finally it causes the degradation or the leakiness of the membranes. So that's the number four mechanisms. And the other one is the sugars or the carbohydrates. And then this is also again in grain sorghum. For this graph, just focus on these two bars. And if you remember that inverted shape, U shape, which I talked about, the effects of heat stress maximum at flowering and gametogenesis, this graph refers to those same thing. So this is at the time of flowering, and then this is at the pre-flowering stages. And these are dark one is starch, pollen germination, and the seed set. So you already saw the pollen germination and seed set. Just focus on this dark line. So this is how it looks like, right? So as you can see, it is the starch content inside the pollen grains which is affected. So why that starch content is affected inside the pollen grains, you may ask, because plants produce tremendous amount of carbohydrates, pollen size is very small. So it cannot meet the requirements of the small pollen. So what happens under those situations, under stress situation, is that carbohydrates reach all the way up to the anther walls. But then the hexose transporters or hexokinases, which are actually responsible for transporting these carbohydrates or sugars into the pollen grain to make them viable, is downregulated, or the invertases and the hexokinases. That's what this data shows. So it's clear that it is not only the amount of carbon, but also the transporters, which are very critical for taking this carbon into the reproductive tissue for determining the viability of them. And then the malfunction or the disruption of this is again dependent upon the various leakiness of the membranes, which are caused by the previous mechanisms which I showed you. Now let's look into the physical effects. So This is a membrane damage or anatomy. This is nice globular pollen as optimum temperature, whereas in the high temperature, because of the membrane damage, because of the other molecules which I talked about, so that you can see the disrupted membranes or the collapsed membrane walls. This is on the pollen grain. And this is similar thing is also on the stigma, normal globular and then nice ovaries, whereas damaged ovaries. And one of the other reasons why these are collapsed is, in case of pollen grains, is the tapetum tissue, which supplies the nutrition to the developing pollen grains, is degenerated. Those membranes are degenerated very fast. And therefore, you see the effect on the viability of these pollen grains. So those are the mechanisms through which it happens in terms of the biochemical mechanisms. But there is also physical mechanisms which is affected. This is called anther indehiscence or stigma reception. And I'm going to show you the data on the, or picture on the right. So what do I mean by anther indehiscence is that there is anthers and the pollen is developed, but they do not dehisce. Unless the good anther dehiscence happen, pollen is not going to fall on the stigma, and the pollination and the pollen germination will not happen. So this is a clear data suggesting that the number of pollen grains on the stigma are affected. Now let's look into the opportunities for genetic improvement and few examples, and also maybe a summary of crop management. So I'm going to give you five examples. Again, three of them are going to be more on the molecular side, and then two are more on the whole plant level. So this is one molecular chaperone, EFTU, which we identified with Zoran Restic in USDA, identified in wheat germplasms. So these are different wheat genotypes. We see that under heat stress, the solid bars, the overexpression of EFTU. And when we finally separated out multiple genotypes, we looked that there was one group of genotypes which are overexpressing the relative amount of EFTU more, and those were the ones which were tolerant to heat stress under field conditions. So that's one example. And the second example is I want to show you is the lipid composition and the lipid content also. These are also different composition of the lipids for two genotypes, Cal92, which is susceptible, and the Wettner, this is the, which is tolerant. This is the Shruti Narayanan's data. So again, this line represents the 0.015, and as you can see, the susceptible ones has more across all the molecular species. So this suggests that the lipid peroxidation is more in the susceptible lines. And the third one is data from John Burke, and this is generally that reproductive tissues do not produce reactive oxygen species. We do not have enough information on that. Sorry, heat shock proteins, not the reactive oxygen species. Therefore, reproductive tissues do not acclimate, whereas photosynthesis acclimates because it can produce heat shock proteins or dehydrants. So in this case, what they did was they took the heat shock proteins from Arabidopsis and put it in tobacco and also in cotton, and then exposed to heat stress. This is non-transgenic, no viability, and this is transgenic. There is some good viability of the pollen grains in tobacco, and the same is also true for cotton. So that's one example. And now, in terms of genetic variability of existing germplasm collections, these are different sorghum lines affected by heat stress, and there are some certain lines which are less sensitive than others in terms of pollen germination. And even in terms of seed set, this is rice genotypes where the percent seed set ranges all the way from 38 to 100%. So there are some sets of rice which are tolerant to heat stress and some are susceptible. So there is genetic variability among the existing field crops, but we need to systematically screen the germplasm collections and then look for opportunities for using them in the breeding program. Now, last two slides. First, I'll talk about we talked about genetic improvement and opportunities for crop breeding. But there are also some things which we can do with crop management. So first thing is understanding the environment is very critical. So look at the long-term data, and if you know what is the likelihood of getting heat stress in a certain month or certain days, then if you can adjust your planting days or choose a variety so that you can escape the stress. And then selection of appropriate crop species. I told you that there is a significant variation amongst the various crop responses, so you might have to choose certain crop to fit into your hydroecology. And then I talked about the varieties or hybrids, and then adjusting the planting days to avoid the stress during the critical stage of development. And if you can manipulate the microclimate, like for providing irrigation, then you can take care of the microclimate, and then also avoid other stresses, nutrient biotic stresses. Some examples of exogenous sprays or growth regulators are also available. And then make sure that whatever you're doing at cellular levels or molecular levels, it is reflected at the whole crop level and directly impacts one of the yield components. So with that, I'll conclude, and then I'll just give you the highlights. Hopefully I've shown you that there is significant progress made in terms of signaling and perception of stress. Short episodes, even one day or 5 days of heat stress, can cause significant damage to the plants by reducing the seed numbers. Food grains are most sensitive to temperature during gametogenesis, flowering, and grain filling. And then whatever trait you're working on, make sure that overall yield and the yield components are affected. Genetic variability exists, but you need to systematically screen those lines. And then there's a critical need to develop high-throughput phenotyping, either molecular markers or biochemical markers to identify the tolerant traits. And then again, I want to emphasize that ensure that your genes or the trait is actually whatever you identify at cellular or molecular level is influencing the trait at the whole plant or the crop level. With that, I will thank the opportunity for giving me the opportunity to share this information. I might be able to take some questions. Thank you. Right now, the information or the responses which I showed you is based on the air temperatures. But in some experiments, we also did measure the canopy temperature, which would be different depending upon crop species. In some species, it may be a little warmer, or in some species, it may be a little cooler as well. All right, thank you.
All right. Our next speaker is going to be Victor Sadras. Victor is a crop ecophysiologist working at the South Australian Research and Development Institute. Victor is well recognized because of his work on adaptation of crops to environmental stresses, including water deficit, temperature, nutrients, soil physical and chemical constraints, pathogens, and insects. And Victor has measured, modeled, and developed theory on aspects of yield quality and the water, carbon, and nitrogen budgets of annual and perennial crops. So it's my big pleasure of inviting Victor to the stage. And by the way, As you can see, my introductions are very short, but all these speakers are well known by all of you, and I don't need too much words, too many words to describe their previous work. But I will let just.